Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are moving right along with what we're calling our family cast tonight. We've got no special extra guests. We've just got some of the gang, and we're going to be talking about some stuff that we've all been participating in from time to time over the course of our careers, and we'll bring you into what that topic is a little bit here. First off, of course, we have to bring in family member number one, the mama of the crew, Sam Bradley.
The EMS mama. That's what they used to call me when we did First Responders Network, EMS mama. But it's been very spring-like here in Colorado. It's actually been pretty nice. I'm not sure about Kyle's more snowy environment in Aspen, but it's been nice down here in the Front Range. So we got BJ with us tonight. We're going to talk to him. And, of course, Kyle, we're going to start with you and to do our little weather report and then talk about some stuff that's going on in the disaster world. Kyle, you want to run with it?
Absolutely. So thanks, Sam, and good day to everyone out there. Just a quick weather roundup, I guess. First of all, you know, here in Aspen, Sam, actually pretty summery for us as well. We're topping out in right around 50 degrees or so. Snow is disappearing here in the valley, but thankfully hanging on up in the mountains. Speaking of weather, though, kind of starting back earlier this past week, we actually had a little outbreak of tornadoes and other severe weather hazards in Louisiana, specifically around the New Orleans area. BJ is on the podcast with us tonight, and he can, of course, color this in as well. But well, there were over 40 reported injuries. Thankfully, there were no fatalities out of this storm. So very, very fortunate situation there. However, a total of 6 confirmed tornadoes so far, with 2 EF3 tornadoes. And that, again, that tornado scale going from EF0 at the smallest to EF5 at the largest. And according to the National Weather Service, some colleagues I have there in New Orleans, it's the only time in a single event that they've had 2 EF3 tornadoes in Southeast Louisiana. And, of course, from that, they received a major disaster declaration from the feds.
And BJ's he sent us a little video that his friend Eddie, who was sitting there teching with him, actually took from the hospital window that was kind of a mind-blower. And, of course, he's saying, get away from the window. So he'll tell you a little bit more about that. But it was pretty mind-blowing. I mean, it looked huge. It looked bigger than an F3 just looking at the video. But anyway, what's that, BJ?
I was just going to say, it was mighty scary looking.
Oh, yeah, that was just one of them. So is there anything coming up around the country, Kyle, that anybody needs to be concerned with this next week or so?
Well,
that we can predict?
Well, yeah, we talked a little bit about prediction in the last episode and how our numerical weather models and our forecasting capabilities have improved. And looking ahead, we're actually looking at more rainfall on the West Coast, all the way from California up through Washington and Oregon State up there. And that's really causing some pretty major concerns. More recently, some of you folks may remember or have heard of the Oroville Dam and the potential failure and evacuation that occurred back on February 12th. So that was, of course, the auxiliary spillway that started having some problems there as that dam, the auxiliary spillway began to be utilized to so the dam would avoid overtopping. Due to some erosion that occurred while that auxiliary spillway was being used, that placed some emergency plans into action, and close to 200,000 folks were evacuated there on February 12th, and those evacuations, mandatory evacuations, I should say, are still ongoing for those nearly 200,000 residents in that area.
And this is, I mean, you know, it's north of where I used to live in California, and of course, we've had droughts for so many years. Now it's gone like the total opposite, and they're supposedly getting more rain this week, which will not help that situation whatsoever. So we're going to have another podcast where we can talk about some of those mass evacuations and how they're handled and how they're pre-planned and that kind of thing. That's for another time. But it's still a story to watch. I know, Kyle, that you're very engaged in the social media piece of this. And, I mean, it got to the point where they said, within an hour, this dam is gone. And that's when I guess they, you know, worked really hard at trying to divert some of the water, and it worked for now. But that story is still yet to be told with the rain that's coming. Is anything else on that that we need to know, Kyle?
Well, I will say in the communications, the flash flood warning product from the National Weather Service there in Sacramento, which covers the area that dam resides in, I have never before seen the National Weather Service use the phrase, "This is not a drill," three times in the same product. So this, of course, has potentially catastrophic effects if that dam or any part of it, would say, were to fail. And so, yes, the social media side did ramp up big time with communication there. Both for state and local agencies that were ramping up their processes there, and really, really amazing to watch it unfold online. I was actually monitoring with a response team that I'm part of with the Epicenter Media and Training Deployment Support Unit. So we were supporting some of the local agencies in that area to monitor for misinformation, rumors, and other questions that folks may have. Again, lots goes into any evacuation, all the pre-planning, but of course, communication is key for any type of emergency, whether it be pre-planned or whether it be a pre-planned event or an emergency. Thanks.
Yeah, I think social media has done so much for the world of disaster, and there's a lot more that can be developed. So before we get into our topic of event medicine, down in New Orleans, where they're really ready for the next hurricane, you guys got a cluster of tornadoes. Like we said, your friend Nettie sitting there actually got a great video of one looking out the hospital window next to her patient. I hope she didn't tell her patient about that. Anyway, how many were there, BJ? Talk a little bit about that experience.
On our end, it's still fairly confusing on the number. As you said, we plan for hurricanes, and although we've had tornadoes that are normally involved with these hurricane issues, to see them independent like this was something that I can't ever remember truly happening, definitely not in this scale, of course. And they were just so devastating in their event and the way they occurred. It's just something we've never prepared for. I was out by the airport when it happened at an office, and all of a sudden we heard the sirens, and I'm like, that's gotta be tornado sirens. I don't think I've ever heard them before. Not even, except maybe for drills. And you got to think, I guess this is one of those things we don't normally train for.
This is not a drill.
That's exactly right. So nothing like a bunch of Southerners trying to figure out what they're supposed to do in the middle of a tornado. It was kind of scary.
Where's the water? We can handle that.
That's right. And Nettie's from Ohio, so she says she's not afraid of the storms. I think she's looking for ruby slippers or something, but that's a totally different story. But yeah, that area out in New Orleans East, the main highway that it was right by is still shut down, a major state highway.
Really?
Still closed due to the amount of debris and issues that came about with it. It ran a major strip through a very suburban area.
Well, tornadoes where they're not supposed to be is interesting. Jamie will remember back, I don't know, a year or so ago, my cousin, who is an ER doc in Denver, was sitting at home in her home office. And she said, ER docs kind of have this thing where the first thing they think when they see a patient is either good or bad, and then they build out from there. And she said she's sitting there in her office and the screen gets sucked out of the window. And the first thing that went through her mind was bad. And following that, the storm door blew off. So she's trying to batten down the hatches. And, it was really interesting. You could still go back and find that podcast. And this was a nice summer day, basically. So, they went outside and saw her neighbors, and they actually saw this tornado because one of the neighbors had just moved and had a bunch of cardboard in a pile. And what happened to the cardboard? Well, look up. It's all going around in this turn. And they took a video and sent it to the media, and that's not a tornado. Oh, really? Well, you're not standing under it. And then it went from there to so much hail, it looked like it was snowing, and then the rain came down to the extent that cars were floating away, and her next-door neighbor had to run out and save this older woman and this kid who were in this car that was floating away. I mean, it was just amazing. And all of this happened in a very short period of time, just from one extreme to the other, to the other, to the other. So, you know, you never know where tornadoes are going to turn up. At least you knew the right things to do about it. But anyway, so how well prepared is New Orleans area or Louisiana in general for tornadoes, BJ? I mean, you were saying it's like, okay, there's a bunch of Southerners trying to figure out, okay, do I stand in the corner? I mean, that's what I remember from being a kid, but how much do you know about what to do?
Those little issues are obviously the problem. The good news, if there's any good news we can pull out of an event such as this, is due to the type of preparedness we do with all the other natural disasters that we've dealt with over the years, is we have a great infrastructure already built for it. So within hours of the event, we had National Guard was mobilized and was on site. They're still doing rotation, shutting down the area. Other agencies had immediately responded from areas that were not affected so that they could pick up the slack and help. It was just a really quick response, and everybody was on top of it with the state very quick. The governor was down here that afternoon to survey the area so that we could put in for federal disaster relief and do all the things that needed to be done to move that forward. So the good news of that is, although I don't know which door I was supposed to stand in or climb onto my table, I did know that after the fact, we were very prepared to take those steps to get people either in some sort of shelter to make sure they had food, they had clothing, they had roofs over their heads, that any injuries were taken care of. All those things were already in the pipeline, and we were able to rely on our other skills to drive us forward.
Well, Louisiana seems to be a good place to be in a disaster these days. That wasn't always the case, but it sure is now. Jamie, did you get tornadoes at all back east?
We do. They're much more uncommon, and maybe Kyle can touch on this because I think it has something to do with the hilly terrain around this area. We just don't see them that often. If we do have one, it's very short lived. And I've always been told that it was because the hills and up and down nature, rolling hills of the terrain here and stuff, tended to break up the low level winds. Is that true?
Well, Jamie, unfortunately, that's one of those weather myths.
Okay.
That's out there.
Uh-oh.
That terrain.
Well, no, that's why we have Kyle here.
No.
But it's good to know. And it's, it is true that up in the Northeast, the tornadoes that do occur are not just, I don't want to say rare, but it's to have very large, long-track tornadoes like you would get, say, in the South around the Great Plains. Those are not so common, but these smaller spin-up tornadoes, as they're sometimes termed, are actually more common in the Northeast. And the hilly terrain breaking up the low-level winds, it can not only just break up those winds, but it can also help to channel the winds in such a way that it causes storms to form and causes the winds to start rotating, perhaps in ways that can actually influence the formation of tornadoes. So that's a weather myth, and just slowly working day by day to put some truth behind the weather here. And of course, the best way to stay on top of it, just staying ahead, looking at the forecast, because depending on where you live here in the U.S., and I know we have listeners all around the world as well, tornadoes can occur any time of year if the conditions are right.
Thank you for clearing
that
up.
Well, Jamie, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we all learned something from that. BJ, you have a question for Kyle.
Yeah, Kyle, you actually brought up a great point when you were kind of explaining that to Jamie. Do you know, as you were looking into what happened down here, as I said, I've been here 50 years and haven't seen anything of this type of magnitude. Was there any special event or was there any sort of changes in patterns that brought this about down here that you know of?
Well, BJ, the tornadoes that occurred down there in your area back on, I think, February 7th it was a combination of some factors coming together. And you know, the three main factors for tornadoes are, of course, ample moisture, which your proximity to the Gulf of Mexico gives you guys plenty of moisture down there.
No doubt.
So moisture. You need vertical wind shear, so we need a change in wind speed and direction with height. and finally a mechanism to lift the air from the surface and cause it to rise and form clouds and things. And that, of course, is because from the daytime heating, because as I'm sure occurred down there, and from what I think I saw doing a little bit of analysis, it was actually a pretty nice day down there before these storms kicked off. Is that true?
Yeah, that is correct. We had just kind of changed weather patterns and started heating up again.
Definitely.
Yeah, I hear that a lot on the that happens in the plains, that some of the worst hurricanes started out as a really nice day, and then boom, here you go. You got a supercell, you got clouds, you got tornadoes. It's like, why does it shift that quickly?
Well, weather can evolve very rapidly when those conditions are right and the ingredients are in place. So that's, you know, even from the morning to the afternoon, that's why we can see the forecast change for both large-scale events, such as, you know, area of heavy rain moving through, or even very small-scale hyper-local events like tornadoes that occur on very, very small time scales and space scales. So they don't last very, very long. They don't affect a large area. But when those ingredients do come together, BJ, I think you hit the nail on the head. You have to be ready to take those actions.
Wow. Well, we could talk about tornadoes all day because I'm fascinated with them. I haven't seen one since I was a kid. But actually, our topic for tonight is event medicine. And Kyle, you just completed the X Games up there in Aspen, which I know very little about. You want to give us a little briefing on what that is and how you guys prepare for them and how you handle them medically?
Sure. I have a great amount of fun with X Games, Winter X Games specifically up here in Aspen, Colorado, where on Ski Patrol, where I work up here, I'm actually the Ski Patrol coordinator for Winter X Games. So I manage the Ski Patrol side of it, but it's not just patrol. It's actually part of a larger medical team. But for Winter X Games, if you're not familiar with it, just let me set the stage for you. And I know my medical providers out there are going to get a kick out of this one. So you have athletes that are traveling 20 to 30 miles an hour on skis and snowboards, and some in excess of 50 miles an hour on snowmobiles and snow bikes, reaching heights of anywhere from 30 to 60 feet above the ground.
Whoa.
And landing on hard snow or ice. So, as you can imagine, this presents a high possibility of significant mechanism of injury and also several unique challenges both for athlete and spectator medical response for us specifically. So our field of play is often snowy, it's icy, very slippery, and of course, incredibly unforgiving. There have been times where medical providers on foot enter into the half pipe only to find out that they lose their footing and slide all the way to the bottom, leaving the patient kind of sitting there waiting for the next provider to come around. But of course, spectators and athletes can become injured anywhere between the base area of our resort, where the X Games is held, all the way up to mid-mountain. So you have a very large geographic area that you're responding to, and of course, our traditional response methods. So our urban providers in ambulances and other all-terrain vehicles and things, and those of us that are on skis, on ski patrol, it's very essential that we work together and have a coordinated response and a pre-plan in place, because we need to utilize the strengths of all our providers like we do for X Games. So we have a medical team that's put together, comprised of a licensed physician that X Games brings in. We also integrate the emergency room doctors and a few nurses at our local hospital in Aspen, members of all four Aspen ski patrols, athletic trainers, local ALS or paramedic level ambulance crews, and an air ambulance crew that's on standby at the airport adjacent to the X Games venue. So many different providers from a host of agencies throughout the valley where Aspen is located, combining their skill sets together to affect a positive outcome for not only the athletes, which of course is our chief concern on Ski Patrol, but of course keeping the spectators safe as well with all the other venues that are running to make sure everyone comes away having a good time.
So how did you do this year? Were there any significant issues or did it all work out well?
Well, Sam, we actually did incredibly well this year. I am beyond amazed at the level to which the patrollers performed. my fellow patrollers, as well as the medical team as a whole. We had several significant injuries that occurred in the field of play with the athletes, as well as on the spectator medical side as well. And thankfully, I believe this, I'm trying to remember the number. I think this was year number 17 or 18, I want to say, that X Games has been hosted here in Aspen. And we have a very strong communications plan in place, as well as a response plan. So being able to get to those injured athletes or spectators, evaluate them, treat them on site, and then transport them and kind of make a decision whether they're going by ambulance, whether they're going to be released under their own medical power, or if we need to perhaps send them to be evaluated by their athletic trainer or perhaps doctor that an athlete might bring along with them. So lots of moving pieces and parts, but overall, I'm incredibly thrilled.
Wow, so glad it went well. It sounds like you guys really have it going on. And I'm sure, as with any event, you have after-action discussions. Is there something new that we might have learned or something weird that happened that we can factor into the updated plan?
Oh, absolutely. Any event, exercise, anytime you get people and resources moving, or even if it's just a tabletop exercise, so just a discussion-based exercise, not a functional one, after action reports are absolutely critical, and we find out, for X Games at least, new things every year. You know, things that we tried, and maybe it worked out well, maybe it didn't work well, and we always strive to continue to improve, as all, you know, agencies should, whether it's medical or otherwise. And I, you know, it's a really, really rewarding piece to be able to, you know, bring these athletes together and the spectators, and put on this TV show for X Games. But ultimately, you know, we're just here to make sure everyone has a good time. And I'll just tell you right now, Sam, the view and the seats, you know, right slope side for these events aren't all that bad.
Yeah, I'll have to try that one time. So, BJ, oh, my God, Mardi Gras. There isn't a crazier event on the planet. And I don't know how many episodes of Cops I've watched looking at how they deal with issues, but we don't hear too much about the EMS side and how they prepare and how they handle those crowds trying to get to somebody. I can imagine it's a, you know, a real tough thing to do. So what can you tell us about Mardi Gras?
It's one of those things. It's kind of like tarot reading beforehand. You have to read cards and make the guesses. It really, I mean, Kyle talked about dealing with your spectators and the athletes, and Mardi Gras is very similar. Most events are. You have a moving show down the middle of the street that can go for 3 or 5 miles, along with hundreds of thousands of spectators lining along the sides of that, cutting off routes, causing access to be difficult. So you're dealing with all the normal things you would expect, like trauma from falls, drunken public. But now you have a full cross-section of the public, and you have all the medical issues that you have to deal with, because you've got people from infants up to 90-year-olds trying to catch doubloons and beads and trinkets on the parade route. So what we've always saw is you really have to start off early, and that's 6 months ago is when you started looking, going, what do we look like? Is this an early Mardi Gras or a late Mardi Gras? And for us, it may seem silly that that's the first question you look at, but a late Mardi Gras, like this year, it's February 28th, or we even have them as late as the beginning of March. Well, what happens there is it's almost guaranteed to be warmer. Warmer means more people are going to look to come down here. Lots of times Mardi Gras will butt up against some other areas, spring break times. So you get a lot of that increase in people coming. So we've got to look at the numbers right there. Warmer also usually means more alcohol, more injuries and issues related to that just due to consumption. So there's always that side of it. But we always worry about crowd size. Crowd size dictates how many responders we're going to need and at what levels and where. So that's kind of the first thing you come up with. And then you're laying out the charts, and it's a thing that changes every day. I'm sure they had different events, like Kyle. I'm sure y'all had quite a few different events where you had different configurations. And Mardi Gras is no different. The parade routes change. Sometimes in the same day, the parades will change directions that they go, and the routes will change. So everybody's got to shift and move. On any day, an individual medic may get a list and have four or five different locations with time stamps that say, okay, this is your first location, then you're going to move here, then you're going to move here, constantly moving with the flow of the crowd, trying to make the best that they can. And then the kind of the funny part of that is, it's not really funny, haha, it's definitely funny peculiar, is that in the middle of all this, you still have a city of 750,000 people, regular residents, who need medical care and treatment in between of all these festivities. And you've got to figure out, how do I get an ambulance to a place that I can't cross the street? How do I get to the
hospital? That was my next question. How do you move around in that crowd?
The trick of it is we really do try to station units in a method that allows us to have somebody in every zone, in every area, so at least one somebody or several somebodies in those areas, so that you can cover both the parade routes and the individual neighborhoods and all that. When it comes right down to it, if you have true emergencies, life-threatening calls, we can get the parade route shut down. We can get the police to move the crowds back. We try not to do that, mostly because it's one of those things that you start putting more people in harm's way, and then is the risk really indicated to put this many people in danger to get across an intersection, or is this something I can go 10 blocks out of my way? And you have to make those calls. Those are tough calls to make, but that's what Mardi Gras turns into.
Yeah, I've thought about Mardi Gras every year, and I thought, you know, it'd kind of be fun, but I don't think I could deal with that many people. That would kind of make me crazy. But you have another event down there that's coming up, don't you, that we don't hear about as much as Mardi Gras, of course.
We've got a couple of other big ones that are coming up right after that. We have French Quarter Festival, which is another one of that's the beginning of April. Everybody knows of the French Quarter. This has started off as a more of a local festival, and it's blossomed since then. And it's another free event, much like Mardi Gras, where they section off six or seven areas inside the French Quarter and put stages up and bands play over a long weekend. And it's specifically to highlight the French Quarter and the businesses and all that in it. So it's grown immensely now that they shut down. There's no moving traffic in the French Quarter during this period of time. Hundreds of thousands of extra people come in there. So it has its own issues that you have to look at and deal with. And then after that, the end of April, first weekend in May and the last weekend in April, we have Jazz Fest, which is another gigantic festival. I think the record is 550,000 attendees. Over the two-week period of time, some ungodly number. By that time, it's so hot, we always end up with lots of heat injuries because there's no place to get out of the sun. Pre-planning becomes a big issue. We try to reduce our number of patients by doing things like putting water stations and anything we can to help cool people off if the weather looks like it's going to be that way. Stationing kind of multiple tier systems where we have people on site to render care if we can do care and release, or if we have to do care and then transport. It's another evolving situation with that.
Well, and of course, people get thirsty, so they drink more beer. And of course, you guys have the humidity too, which I think is one of the worst pieces of it.
The sweat never goes away. Yeah. Once you start, it doesn't have any place to go, so it definitely causes its own set of problems.
Well, and I can imagine that people just don't hydrate with water as they should because they're too busy drinking alcohol, which, of course, has the opposite effect because it's dehydrating them even more. So I can.
And you know, one of the things that we as the medical providers, as the emergency responders, we have no control over this. But when the guys walk up and a bottle of water is $3 and a beer is $4, I'm almost certain I know which choice they're going to make, and that always lends to our problem further down the line. But it's just kind of because of the way the system ends up being set up. We that's how we end up with some of these issues.
Well, we have the exciting ice sculpture festival here in Loveland, but unfortunately it was so warm, most of the ice sculptures didn't last that long, but obviously that doesn't bring in quite as many people. What kind of thing do you have back east that you might have annually, Jamie?
In our area, actually, we have a one of the biggest international equestrian centers right in our county. And so it holds events all the time, including steeplechase horse events. Those are spread out. The crowds are spread out across some rather rough terrain, and it's difficult to get to them. So we have a lot of people, EMS providers, riding around on gators and other four-wheeled all-terrain vehicles to get to the different areas where the crowds are set up. It's kind of like a very spread out tailgating event, if you could picture that, across a couple of miles of hilly, grassy, and forested terrain that the horses race through, leaping over different obstacles along the way. So you have, again, same things that Kyle described, where you can have the horses injured, you could have the riders injured, and of course you have people out in the middle of the summertime where you get heat-related illnesses and injury. You get people that twist an ankle or something like that. All sorts of things can happen with both the athletes and the spectators, and you have to be prepared for all of that. So that's just one thing that happens. Just not too far away from me, we have Washington, D.C., where they had the inauguration recently. They had the Women's March. They have other events throughout the course of the year that occur in Washington, D.C. that require some level of event response to prepare for those people there. So it's a lot to keep track of. But as with the medical response to the X Games, as with New Orleans' response and preparedness, there's all it all comes from a place of organizations that are used to dealing with the things that they're prepared to deal with. The preparations start months in advance, and the organizations make sure that things are staffed appropriately for both the events and the surrounding community near the event. And so it's not much different.
Yeah, it is interesting. That's a very big departure from, you know, equestrian event, from the X Games, and from, you know, what VJ's talking about. But we've got to get close to wrapping up here. But VJ, you had a little story to tell us to wrap this up, didn't you?
Yeah, I just wanted to. I do some obstacle races. You've heard of like Tough Mudder and Warrior Dash.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They've been very popular and they're all around. They have their own issues and I haven't worked them, but I've, I was going to run in them, but my body doesn't run. It kind of chucks. Mostly, but we were just at a race a few months ago, and they had a major malfunction on one of their obstacles that collapsed. Ended up having to get multiple air evacs in. This is at a fairly rural area, obviously, because this is a race over quite a few miles of rugged terrain. And it kind of put them in a rough spot because although they were staffed and they had what was required by the state and all that, I don't think they expected to end up with a mass casualty event dealing with a dozen people all at one time. And it became quite an overwhelming experience for them.
Wow. And Jamie, what this is making me think of is, you know, we're talking about very different incidents, but we're talking about a lot, like Kyle alluded to, a lot of moving parts and a lot of contingencies that people have to be prepared for, which, of course, involves a whole lot of training of a whole lot of people. And, you know, that training, just like our ski patrol refreshers, Kyle, I imagine you have to go over this stuff annually as you prepare for an event. It just reminds me that's what our friends at Paragon do. Dr. Joe isn't with us this week. He's off to the Eagles Conference where all the top-end bigwigs talk about things, high-end things in medicine. So hopefully we'll hear about that later. But, you know, I could just imagine, you know, all of these events take such a high level of training that it's just inconceivable.
Well, it starts with planning and being prepared for the event. And so it just like just like Kyle said, just like BJ has said, I alluded to it, so did you, that it takes, you know, the planning starts months ahead of time. And the same thing is true for the training. And I think that's one of the things that Paragon does such a great job with, is that they can bring any sort of major event training program into your system, whether it's to handle these kinds of things, or to handle, be prepared for a disaster, unexpected event. And so I would urge you to check them out. You can find them over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can also check them out at ParagonMedEDU on Twitter. And there's always a link from our site as well at DisasterPodcast.com. So follow up, check them out, and let them know that you appreciate their continued support of the Disaster Podcast, which brings this show to you every week. So check them out and find out what they're all about and see what they can do to bring better training systems and situations into your setup. Kyle, you had one final point you'd like to make about dealing with event care.
Yeah, Jamie. Just one thing I want to kind of drive home, a point that I really wanted to make, is that when it comes to, you know, event medicine or even disaster medicine, it's important to remember that the medical protocols under which you operate aren't changing. The venues in which you're applying them are. And so you're not having to do any heroics, going above and beyond. It's being confident in your skill set and being able to perform your day-to-day duties. Now you're just doing it in a little bit different environment. So don't forget, you're not changing the way that you operate. You're changing usually where you operate.
Right, the environment. Good point. Good point. Really good point, Kyle.
Kyle, while we have you on, where can folks find you?
Well, folks can find me across all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. Please feel free to link me, friend me, follow me, etc. Follow along with all the good happenings out here in Aspen, Colorado.
Excellent. And BJ, how about you? Want to tell folks a little bit about your podcast?
Sure, definitely.
Yay!
Find me at wordsoffthestreet.com. That's a podcast that we're doing that's a discussion with public safety writers, police, fire, EMS. Every week we're interviewing a different person, hearing their background, how they moved through public safety and how they got into writing. Lately we've been talking to some people like I just interviewed Greg Fries with EMS1. He's the editor-in-chief, with a great interview with him. I have an interview with the publisher of Caliber Press coming up. All kinds of great interviews to hear about where these great writings and these learning things that we see all the time in our business come from.
And it's a great podcast. Sometimes. It's a really great show. I urge everybody to check it out, and that's wordsoffthestreet.com. Just a great show. Sam, what did you have something to say?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, sometimes we just, what we all do, we do what once a month or so, BJ, we just get a bunch of us together and we talk about, throw out some questions and just have a giggle fest and a good time. So when he's not interviewing a guest, we got a bunch of silliness going on, but it's a lot of fun. So we enjoy that too.
Awesome. Sam, what about you? Where can folks find you?
The usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And, if we're doing shameless plugs here, you can find a lot of our books up on Amazon. And BJ's even working on an audio book for one of his, so stay tuned for that. And Jamie, how many do you have up there now?
I think I've got 9 books published right now, and the 10th book's coming out the end of this month, so right about a little bit after the time this episode airs. I'll have a new book out there for you, the 6th in my Extreme Medical Services series, The Paramedic's Nemesis. Dun, dun, dun.
And those books are a lot of fun, especially EMS providers. Nobody writes stuff that we can really get such a kick out of. So, you know, take medicine and the paranormal and put them together and with Jamie's imagination. And it's well worth a look. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was a fun book. I'm running through the final passes for it now, and it's in the hands of my esteemed beta reader, aka my wife. And so
you don't pay her much, do you?
Waiting. No, but she gets paid by getting to read them before everybody else does, and she just waits for them patiently. And so I just handed her Kindle loaded with the new book tonight. So
And she's reading as we speak.
Probably.
So So there you go. If you want more of us, you can see what we write up on Amazon. There you go.
Excellent. So, Sam, you know, we've got a lot going on in this episode, but it's been just a great episode all the way around. We started off talking about some weather events that have happened and going some more depth on what the response was like for them and what's going on there. And then we've segued into talking about event care. And as Kyle pointed out, it doesn't change our protocols or the basic aspects of what we do when we do our jobs. It just changes the location often and makes a few changes there. But we're still providing the same basic care that we always provide for our patients. And I think that, you know, event medicine and advanced disaster medicine and austere medicine, it all comes down to what you say every week.
That's, and what we say is, disaster medicine's not our everyday medicine. But before we take off tonight, we want to remind people to come over to the disasterpodcast.com website or come over to the Facebook page on Facebook and join up with us. And a lot of the people that you've heard on our podcast are there. If you want to have continued discussions or provide some ideas for another podcast you might have an interest in, please do.